Here on Eye on the Illini, we're having another big episode. Up next, Mark Sutter, the man who defended Terrence Shannon Jr.
If you're trying to quit drinking or doing too many drugs, listen to me. You don't know me and we'll never meet. I had a problem like you once. I drank and used to party a little too much till it got out of control and almost ruined my life. I realized I needed help to fix my problem before it totally destroyed me. If you've tried to fix your drinking and drug problem and you know you can't do it alone, you need to call the National Treatment Advisors. They'll immerse you into a 30-day program to replace your old habits with new habits and totally change your life. And if you have PPO private health insurance, the entire program may be covered. Fix your problem right now before it gets any worse. Get clean. Call now and learn more. 800-961-2480. 800-961-2480. 800-961-2480. 800-961-2480.
Are you looking to grow your business? Do that with the Illini Guys Radio Network by advertising on the Illini Guys Sports Spectacular. The weekly two-hour syndicated show airs on more than 20 stations and is heard in six states throughout the Midwest, including Chicago, St. Louis, the Quad Cities, Peoria, Bloomington, Springfield, Champaign, Decatur, Rockford, and Quincy, just to name a few, with a reach of more than 11 million people. For information, send an email to mike@illiniguys.com and let's work together to grow your business. That's mike@illiniguys.com and let the power and reach of the Illini Guys Network work for you.
Welcome to Eye on the Illini. We have really a treat today. Mark Sutter is here from Sutter Law Group, and if you don't know who he is as an Illini fan, I'm not certain what I can do to introduce you, but I will say Illini fans have watched this case, and to be honest, people much beyond just the Illini Nation, with the fact that Terrence Shannon Jr. was going to court and fighting for his personal freedom. Mark Sutter was the lead attorney and has coordinated a fantastic effort. Mark, thank you so much for coming on Eye on the Illini to discuss the case.
Mike, thanks for having me.
One of the things I wanted to say up front, and this is something also so that our listeners will understand that I'm sensitive to the fact that you're Terrence Shannon Jr.'s lawyer, and you don't want to jeopardize attorney-client privilege that protects legal advice sought and given between him and his lawyers. And if any of my questions that I ask for information might be protected, feel free to say no. And again, that's for the listeners to understand what we're doing here in this interview.
I appreciate that. Thank you for respecting that.
But, so you practiced law in Illinois. Before this case, had you ever worked a case in the Douglas County District Court in Kansas?
No, sir. I have not. We do a lot of media cases here locally, but we didn't have a case out there with all the separate components to it. And then a foreign territory, it was challenging in the beginning.
Speaking of the foreign territories, clearly you worked with the local criminal defense firm of Bath & Bath in this defense. How did you find out about them? And what about them made you select them to help in the responsibility of defending Terrence Shannon Jr.?
So certainly everybody has access to the internet and we look on, you know, best local attorneys. And I did some vetting that way, but I also have some personal contacts that are from the Kansas City area. And I asked them for names of the best in the state. Couple that with some of the other people that I vetted out through my own research. I ended on Tom Bath and Trisha Bath. Then in the beginning, middle and end, and in retrospect, they were the greatest decision we've ever made. So I give a huge shout out to, my trial partner, Trisha Bath, and her husband, Tom, who would have been trying the case probably with us or at least in some way he would have been there, but he was also on trial in another case in another county. So all the way up until the day of trial. In fact, we went out together as a team, three of us, and analyzed all the jury backgrounds when we picked the jury. So I felt like he was sitting next to me even when we were picking the jury, even though he wasn't, because all of his notes were on the paperwork.
Well, that's fantastic. You know, that goes into a couple different questions. Before I get into jury selection, for those people who aren't lawyers or don't have the experience with the courts, how does this effort work, and how did you coordinate, you know, your work with the Baths and to make one cohesive case for Terrence Shannon Jr.?
So to make it, to break it down from A to Z, it'll make it probably the easiest for all the listeners and the fans that the stuff they don't already know, at least this will fill in the blanks. When Terrence came back from a football game back in September, he was a person of interest. He didn't know it. He didn't know what was going on. His athletic department found out through a mutual contact on one of the coaching staff. They reached out to me knowing that I do this work here in Illinois. I stepped in. We sort of got involved in the initial investigation. And then, as you may now know, the investigation, the detective there didn't do much to kind of make an effort to come out to talk to TJ. So I was always of the opinion to let sleeping dogs lie. I mean, that's what defense attorneys do. So I don't call police to ask them to, you know, please come out and interview my clients. Right. So they never came out. The next thing we knew, they came out and took a swab of his cheek for DNA. TJ cooperated. We didn't hear anything. And then the next thing you know, without any rhyme or reason, we found out that there was a warrant for his arrest in Lawrence, Kansas. So then he reached out to me. I suggested that he go out there and handle it rather than go through the Illinois process of extradition, et cetera. We got him out there. He surrendered, was processed, and was let out hours later. And the staff from Illinois drove him back. On the car ride back, everything kind of hit the fan, and he found out that he was going to be suspended. This is right around the Christmas holiday break. I happened to be in another state with my family. I got the call, and that's when the work really started happening, where I started vetting out. My first order of business was to find criminal representation so that I could represent him in Kansas, because I'm not licensed there. I have to get what's called pro hoc vice. So I have to petition the Supreme Court there, but I have to have local counsel in place as my sponsor. So once that was done, I knew we were going to kind of kick the can out there and then focus on the civil stuff and trying to get him back on the basketball court. So that's when Rob Lang from Thompson Coburn, I had another Steve Beckett, Mark Goldenberg, all these guys, two guys from Springfield, one from Chicago. And we all collaborated and focused on the preliminary injunction stuff that ultimately got resolved in the federal central court, central district federal court in Springfield, Illinois. So that judge granted the injunction. Terrence became reinstated back on the court. We went through everything. And once the tournament was done, then Illinois investigated. That was ultimately dismissed for want of prosecution, and they couldn't get enough evidence, and the victim didn't want to cooperate with the investigation in Illinois. So then we had, the only thing left on the table was the criminal case. We went out there last month and did the preliminary hearing where only the victim testified. The court found probable cause. And then we came out 30 odd days later and started picking a jury. So it was the fastest from preliminary to jury trial that I've ever experienced in my almost 30 year career.
So when we talk about, you know, picking the jury, you know, as I understand it, the jury pool is kind of racially monolithic, overwhelmingly white and few people of color. So there wasn't much you could do to select a jury that would be diverse racially, as some lawyers might have tried. What type of jurors were you trying to select to make sure it was the fairest case possible?
It's a good question. We had a couple of different sort of, you know, types of people, but ultimately we wanted to get people that were intelligent enough to challenge the evidence in the face of such an egregious allegation. I mean, when you're talking about an allegation like that, nobody should take it lightly. So, and nobody does. But to win this case, we realized that we had to have people that were strong, and, you know, whether they were whatever color, race, religion, it didn't really matter. We kind of wanted to hear, you know, what they did, what they were about, You know, you're right. It's unfortunate that what the demographic is, but more importantly, you know, for juries, they need to collectively be intelligent enough and strong enough individually to be able to, like I said, challenge the evidence and then ultimately come together if that's what makes sense. And we put a police officer on the stand, and I've always been taught in my years, I was a prosecutor back in the day and tried cases against some of the greatest defense lawyers in the city of Chicago. And they would never put a police officer on the stand, you know, as a defense attorney. But this particular one just had a lot of integrity, and I thought he's going to be a great foreman for us. Trisha Bath and I had that pegged from the first day we picked him. And when we ultimately saw him come out holding the verdict forms, we looked at each other and kind of nodded that, yeah, you know what, it's, I think this is going our way. So we've been strategizing from the very beginning. You know, we never stopped strategizing on this case. So when he came out, we knew we were in good shape, and we had a couple others on the jury that were, you know, sort of like super intellectual. Like I think there was a professor of like criminal justice on, you know, various students, college students, to kind of offer some relevance to what we're talking about. And so it was good. I think we picked a good jury. I was pretty happy with it. You know, you never know when you pick a jury. That's what I hate about juries, essentially. In Illinois, you don't have to pick a jury. You can waive a jury, and a defendant can have a bench trial. If you think it's a significant legal case and you're going to win on the law and not on the facts, you know, then you take a bench trial. If you have to, you know, sort of inject some emotion or try to show some reasonable doubt other ways, you know, where a judge is going to shake their head and not be convinced, you pick a jury to kind of send a different message. But to be forced into a jury trial was a new experience for me. So I think we handled it well. And once again, I think, you know, the Baths and their clerks, they had interns. Their whole team, it was a complete team effort from start to finish.
Did you use any of your peremptory ability to maybe get a few people out of the pool, so to speak? And if you did, what was the strategy? What scared or concerned you that made you use those?
So the way they do it in Kansas, they qualify 45 people out of a 75 person veneer. And 45 people get qualified. And as that 45 number is sort of being massaged from both sides, each side is making a claim or staking a claim that that particular person cannot be fair and impartial for one reason or another. And a lot of personal history or, you know, things that affected these jurors were popping up. The court did a great job of bringing them in back, so not to sort of poison the jury. She would talk to them one-on-one and find out that for whatever reason, they didn't believe the police. They really believe the police. They, you know, don't believe sexual assault victims. They only believe sexual assault victims. You know, it was all over the board, but ultimately the judge ferreted out all the people that couldn't be fair and impartial. Then they all go away. And then you're left with 45. And then the state gets 15 strikes and we get 15 strikes, and that eliminates 30, leaving 15, 12 jurors and three alternates. So we kind of remembered what people said, and, you know, we took a copious notes, and we just, you know, a lot of it is feel.
Okay.
It's just, you know, that's how we picked.
Well, it was very successful, as you said. So one of the questions that we've been asked a lot, especially in the wake of a lot of these political, for lack of a better words, political oriented trials, Terrence took the stand for himself, which we haven't seen a lot in some of the public trials recently. How hard of a decision was that for you as your team was thinking about what do we do? How did you make that decision?
So if you rewind to the preliminary hearing, I was so confident with Terrence and his, you know, passion and forthrightness, and the fact that I knew in my heart that he didn't do it. I mean, these are the worst clients to have as a criminal defense attorney, is the innocent ones. You know, they, most of the people that come to me are may not be.
Right.
So with that in mind, it puts a lot of pressure in it, and it sort of changes the game. And when the preliminary hearing came around, I mean, like I said, I've been a lawyer, practicing lawyer for almost 30 years. I mean, I passed the bar in 96. So I've only done, majority of my stuff has been in the criminal setting. And I've never in my life called a client to testify at his own preliminary hearing, because the burden of proof is just so low, it doesn't make sense to lock him in and potentially get cross-examined. But we made a strategic decision then to have him testify in hopes that the judge would see this and realize this is like he said, she said, with no other real eyewitness testimony. And even the victim's identification was rather weak. We thought maybe the judge would throw the case out at prelim. So we had him testify in hopes we'd win there. And then when we didn't, we knew we were going to call him to the stand at trial anyway, because the jury needed to hear from him.
That was a splendid move. And of course, you people who haven't had the ability to get close to Terrence, whether it's, you know, real close on a basketball court, when you see somebody that's 6'6" and 230 pounds, but yet has such a very soft demeanor, it's really something it's hard to predict, because you don't anticipate that at all from a man that size.
I forget what Reba Daniels called him, but it was so appropriate.
A little bit like a gentle giant, you know?
I think so. I think that's might have been what she said. Yeah. So,
So the one of the questions that also came up is I don't want to that you might argue with this description, but you were pretty harsh during your closing argument assessing the DA's decision to bring this lawsuit. What about this case stood out to you that made you act that way? Because you've got a long experience at this. So what were the parts that made you get a little bit, I'm just going to use the word frustrated, but that this even made it to trial?
That's a fair assessment. I've been called a lot worse than frustrated.
It's a family show.
Yeah. Mike, honestly, what happened to me, why I really did get frustrated, is the timeline of events that this detective took or didn't take that really caused me pause on someone that was a prosecutor in his day. I've gone through what they used to call, and what they still call in Cook County, Chicago, is felony review. We had, you know, seasoned prosecutors, their job on felony review was to test the evidence, talk to detectives, talk to witnesses, do all those things to make sure that these allegations, that this case that you're bringing into the system with all the other things that come attached to it, are legit. And, you know, I've rejected cases as a felony review as trial assistant, and detectives would get mad at me on murder cases and things that we had a victim, but, you know, ballistics were off, or there was something wrong that just didn't make enough sense, where I would either tell them to continue the investigation, Or I wouldn't personally approve it, and they'd have to go over my head to a higher supervisor. And that was felony review. So when I look at this case, and I thought to myself, you know, this detective sent in a probable cause affidavit, which is the green light for prosecution. And then the DNA wasn't even sent in yet. So I think he did the affidavit on October 4th, didn't talk to any witnesses, didn't talk to anybody at the bar, didn't go to the bar and take photographs or meet with the victim or anything. She came to his department with her girlfriend. That was basically the extent of the investigation. But empirically, he ignored the science, the DNA, and so did the prosecutor. So my objection was really that I get that it was charged. That was a rush to judgment. I don't think it should have been charged in the first place if they would have done all their due diligence and waited for the results of these tests before submitting a PC affidavit. Maybe they would have got the DNA results and saw no DNA in the vaginal vault or on the labia. You'd have to scratch your head and go back to this girl and be like, hey, by the way, you know, the DNA is sort of contradicting what you've said to us. You know, ask some more questions. At the very minimum, they didn't do that. And then they charged the case. And then the DA charged the case, I want to say before the results were even back. Before the report was generated, the official charges came through. So I guess they could have fixed that. They knew or should have known that this DNA was deficient. And, you know, I was sort of incensed by that knowing what this guy went through and the ridicule and all the things that, you know, he made it look easy. But what people don't realize is that deep down, that's painful. You know, they inflicted a lot of pain on him in these last 9 months, and they did it sort of willy-nilly. And that's what aggravated me the most.
A lot of people don't understand how much it can cost to mount an effective defense. He had at least two law firms, maybe a private investigator, a DNA expert, other experts probably behind the scenes. You know, first off, did Terrence have any help to get all that done? And then the second question, which I admit is a loaded question, but how does your average person, 23 years old, who gets charged with something like this, how would they fare in this type of case? Because, boy, it seems like the deck is certainly stacked against a defendant in this type of situation.
So your first question is protected by attorney-client privilege, confidential, you know, fee agreements, and those kinds of things. Okay. I can't reveal that. That's for him to disclose if he wanted to. The second part of your question was actually resonated in my closing argument that, God forbid, you know, I think I said something to the effect that, you know, I live in Illinois and I'm not a huge fan of Illinois and some of the things that go on here. And I told the jury, I think one of the only reasons I'm happy to be living in Illinois is that I'm not living in Kansas. And I said that, you know, I think it's terrible that, you know, that you as jurors, as citizens, could be subjected to this sort of malicious prosecution. I don't think I use those words, but to the effect that, you know, if an indigent defendant didn't have the ways and means to have effective counsel, to challenge the evidence, to hire phone experts and DNA experts and do all the things that you referenced, I don't know, Mike, what the outcome is going to be. And we all know that the Innocence Project's out there for reversing wrongful convictions. And as I told the detective from the get-go, when you, I forget what the words were, something like, if you make mistakes, it leads to inaccurate conclusions, and inaccurate conclusions lead to wrongful convictions. If you don't have the money or the effort to, or the skill to test that stuff, you're left with potentially a wrongful conviction. So yeah, you're right. You're right on with that.
You've got Terrence, obviously, in the future. Do you think he will pursue a civil lawsuit against the DA, the alleged victim, or both? We understand there's a statute of limitations for at least 1 year for at least malicious prosecution claims. Is he going to take some time to think about it? How do you see that playing out?
Right now, we're focused on him being drafted and following his dreams. The lawyers are... his legal team's always in conversation. We'll just put it that way. But I can't specifically comment on that right now.
Yeah. And of course, as Illini fandom is very excited as well about wanting to hear his name called in the first round of the NBA draft, as one of the things that we talk about on Illini Guys with Larry Smith, Brad Sturdy, and Kedrick Prince. We talk about our expectations was he would have been a lottery pick. He probably would have been runner up for National Player of the Year, and he probably would have been a first team All-American. So the damage that has been done, and not even looking at the personal as how he feels, has been tremendous. I'm assuming that you, as a lawyer, as somebody who obviously understands sports, that had to be going through your mind as well.
All I can tell you, Mike, is all those damages are quantifiable.
Yeah, that's a good answer, and one that will probably bring a potential smile to some people's faces. Was there any cause or any need for you and your team to communicate with Josh Whitman and the University of Illinois once the case in Kansas was going on? And if so, how would you characterize, was that a, if they did happen, was there good teamwork there as well?
I think they were put in a position. They sort of built a wall around themselves. So in the beginning, we were having conversations, and then we were informed they had hired their own legal counsel, and then our team basically communicated only through legal counsel.
Okay. You had the opportunity to obviously get close with Terrence. What about him, in your assessment, made him be able to keep such a laser focus on basketball? And he never had, at least that anybody could see publicly, a frustration, anger. What was it? The support of his family? Was it him himself, a combination? But your assessment, how do you think he was able to do that? Because I look at myself as a 57-year-old, that is incredibly stressful. And I don't think I would have handled it that well.
Well, I know how much sleep I've lost, so I couldn't imagine him. But he gives all the glory to God, and he has a really, really solid family. And when you have that, you can get through anything in life, as we all know. And he knew he was innocent of these charges. He always was so focused. I mean, even when we were in Kansas, he was training every night. I would go to the office, and he would go to the gym and then do the same thing the next day. And even when this was going on and they sort of excommunicated him from the team in the beginning, they didn't take away his rights and privileges. So he was in the gym every morning at, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, every single day by himself or with his trainer, even though he knew that he couldn't practice with the team. The kid is incredibly focused and incredibly mature for his age. And yet he and I have this sort of, I don't want to say father son, because I don't want to age myself. But I have a 21-year-old at home, and he's 23. So it's kind of in that range. I'd like to maybe call myself an uncle.
Yeah.
But he's a kid too. Like he's giddy, and he eats candy, and he's just he's emotional. He's just a sweetheart of a kid. He's a muscular man. And I think his heart is probably the biggest muscle on his body. So, I give a lot of credit to his family, his mother, especially. She's really, really been amazing throughout this whole thing, and to keep him grounded. And even as he moves forward, as I don't know if you followed the trial or when Coach Anderson testified. Yes. Read any of that transcript, but he's got his old crew of grammar school buddies that were all there, and they all hang out and they all motivate each other, and they're all just wonderful, wonderful humans. And when you have that kind of support, you can get through anything. Not to say that it didn't cause pain and suffering to him.
Yeah, that's excellent to hear. And I don't know if you can answer this one, but have you ever experienced a more unprofessional and maybe even borderline incompetent prosecutor than what you experienced here?
I've always told prosecutors, young especially, that get frustrated with cases that, I mean, it's easy to look like a hero when you have good facts. Good facts make good lawyers. And I assess professional people by how professional they are. And, Ricardo Leal and his partner, Samantha, would have been much better lawyers had they had much better facts and they didn't have to take so much water as they did. Now I do agree that he might have at times shown some inexperience, but he'll learn with the trial of more cases. He'll learn. And again, I don't want to classify him as I forget the adjective you used, but he's just younger. And, this case was thrown on their lap. They didn't have much time to prepare. So, and for what I heard, they were sort of being told by, higher ups on how to direct the case and things to argue. So it's really difficult as a former prosecutor. When we handle the bigger cases, I handled them from the time the detective started talking to people. And I worked with them, and we went through my own felony review, and then I did the grand jury indictment, and I would do all the steps, you know, so that you get married to these files. It's really hard. They had a difficult task, and I think they handled themselves with dignity. Now, would I have, you know, employed some of the same strategies as them? Probably not.
Terrence turned down the opportunity to plea bargain, and I wonder if any of that is, you know, anything you can talk about in terms of the strategies that you employ when you're thinking of something like that, and then how you applied those to this case.
Well, I could tell you the terms of their offer was a message to me that they didn't properly assess their case. Because I don't know really what they were thinking by coming to us with an offer that I wouldn't recommend anyway. But even before we talked about any details, Terrence was adamant he wasn't pleading guilty. He was not going to plead guilty to something that he didn't do, regardless of whether this was reduced to a misdemeanor or, you know, anything like that. He was going all the way. So I have to give him a lot of credit for that. And I think it also speaks volumes to his integrity and his fortitude that that he didn't do it.
Right.
You know, it's right. Really, it's a lot easier to reject a plea when you didn't do something, as opposed to someone else trying to, you know, make the best of a bad situation or minimize. He all he thought about was, wait, and I have to plead guilty? Absolutely not.
Another question is, when you step back and you look at this case now, are there any lessons to be learned or any messages that people can take forward from what happened here?
I think there's some people in Kansas that might have learned some lessons. But I think if there's a lesson to be learned, it's that I need to relax a little bit more. And you know, athletes, actors, public figures in general, it's a message to them that they need to mind their P's and Q's when they're in public, because with cameras and things and what goes on, you always have to act like a true gentleman or woman when you're out in public and anywhere for that matter, because you never really know if you're going to get that phone call and all of a sudden you're a person of interest and not really know where that emanated from.
That's incredible. We were covering the Kansas game, ran into Coach Underwood, you know, and little did we know what was also, you know, on the weekend timeline was going on. Just crazy to think that. It now, of course, this case is come to a close. What's next for you?
I just got my Arizona law license. So I don't know. I'm working with some firms out there to try to figure out a way to leave the Chicago winters. That's on my immediate sort of professional horizon. I still have a high schooler at home, so we're getting ready for her trip to college, and I got two others in college, so I'm not going anywhere, and I'm still paying bills, Mike. So yeah. I'm here when people need me. I call sutter.com has been my moniker, and people know how to find me, and they do. So I'm happy to help, and I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. I think eventually maybe someday I'll take less cases and work less hours, but I don't think as long as I can walk and talk, I don't think I'm going to ever give up being a lawyer.
Well, that is fantastic to hear. Thank you so much for coming on the Eye on the Illini. The one final question I want to ask you is, was there anything that you thought I would ask or anything that you wanted to say that we didn't get through in this discussion we had?
Not particularly a question. I mean, I know that you're better at that than I am. The one thing I would say is across the board is I never really realized how strong and how deep Illini fans are and the alums. Rob Lang, who you're going to be interviewing in a couple days, my co-counsel on the other civil side, he's a diehard Illini fan, season ticket holder. And just the support that the Illinois fans have shown and, you know, sports fans, and now the feedback and the public feedback we're getting. And I just, we're real thankful for that. And that would be one message that I'd want to send to your fandom. Just a simple thank you for all the support and for keeping an open mind. I know there were a lot of naysayers out there and a lot of people getting on the bandwagon and people making, you know, ridiculous chants at TJ. But kids are kids. I hope in all their hearts that were chanting those things are thinking to themselves, man, I owe this kid an apology. And I hope that they've apologized to their God for TJ's alleged indiscretions, because I think at this point we've vindicated him. And after the evidence was shown, we not only proved that they didn't show the case beyond a reasonable doubt, we proved it wasn't him.
Yeah, that is so important. And I think all of us got a little bit of an education on innocent until proven guilty. No matter what our background is, we're conditioned sometimes to assume, and particularly when it's a celebrity or an athlete or a political figure, it's kind of assumed that they just did it. And we're seeing now that people of good character, when they say they don't do it, that's what they mean. And I think Terrence has done an excellent job of providing that illustration for many of us.
Well, Mike, thanks for having me. I appreciate the time. And we're all going to keep an eye on Terrence and watch him fly.
The first thing we want to see is a nice draft selection in the NBA draft. And then we'll start having fun cheering him on at that next level, wherever that is. Maybe a team like the Bulls, and then everybody selfishly can go watch Io and Terrence together. What a great time that would be for Illini fans.
It would be phenomenal. And then you could take up the cause to get his jersey hung at in the rafters. I know that's going around right now. I think he does that too.
Yes, I think that is universal amongst Illini fandom. It's pretty clear. Again, he was on a pace to be the second. I don't know that I love Terrence, but I don't think he was going to pass up Edie the way Edie played this year. But I thought he would have been the runner-up. And, you know, the All-American, consensus All-American would have been easy. And, boy, that would have been something to see. But what we got to see was a little different. And yet, at the same time, you had somebody who was given a bushel of lemons and came out with gallons of lemonades. That's a thing that hopefully NBA GMs are looking at.
Agreed. Have
Excellent.
A great afternoon, Mike.
Thank you, sir.
Whether you live in Champaign or Chicago, halfway across the country, or on the other side of the world, IlliniGuys.com keeps you in the know. Be it in-game results, top-level stories, or the latest behind-the-scenes info and recruiting, IlliniGuys.com has you covered. For about 25 cents a day, you can have an inside path to your favorite Illini teams. And we'll even throw in a free 7-day trial to kick the tires. Go to IlliniGuys.com, click the register button, and get immediate access to dozens of stories each month, message forums, free giveaways, and more. IlliniGuys.com.
Have you ever tried to buy gold and silver and felt like you were talking to a used car salesman? That's because the precious metals industry is like the Wild West. Salesmen can say pretty much anything or make any promise they want without repercussion. But Genesis Gold Group is different. They're a faith-driven Christian precious metals company and believe in educating their customers, not pressuring them for a quick sale. Genesis Gold Group focuses on customer service, not sleazy marketing. Genesis Gold Group is named after the first book of the Bible for a reason. Proper stewardship of wealth is their specialty. Find out why they've earned a 5 out of 5 rating through the Better Business Bureau and how they can help you secure your wealth or retirement through physical precious metals. Call right now to learn more.
800-238-3714. 800-238-3714. 800-238-3714. That's 800-238-3714.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Of course, thanks to Mark Sutter for coming on. Fantastic guest. Gave you some insight as to what's going on behind the scenes while he was defending Terrence Shannon Jr. We hope you enjoyed it. Of course, you can subscribe to the Illini Guys, www.illiniguys.com. You get everything, inside information, you get news stories, you get podcast videos, and you get our message boards. That is where we can put the things that, you hear rumors and nobody wants to go on the record. That's where it's at. You can hear about things ahead of time. You don't have to be surprised. It's nice to know information. It's nice to be the guy at the water cooler who actually knows what's going on ahead of time when you're at work. Go to IlliniGuys.com. Hit and go ahead and register. $99 a year. We guarantee you will love it. And once you get on board that way, you probably aren't going to want to stop. Secondly, if you are listening to this or you're watching it on YouTube, you can go to the IlliniGuys.com YouTube channel. Hit subscribe. That way you get our new offerings when they come out. It's a lot of fun. You want to make sure you get them hot off the presses. Please do that. And of course, you have the Eye on the Illini Twitter at Eye on the Illini. You can go to mine at Mike Kegley, Cagley. You can follow on Twitter, get all the information up to date at IlliniGuys.com. We really, really want to get a community of Illini fans. And with the message boards, you guys can all come together, talk about Illini sports. It's a ton of fun. Until we meet again on Eye on the Illini, go Illini.